When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at MSNBC.com/app.
All right, good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Wednesday, December 1st. We've got lots of questions this morning and the very right people to answer them. Is the new strain of COVID already inside the United States? We're going to talk to the U.S. Surgeon General about that. What is New York City's plan to fight back against the virus? The outgoing mayor joins the conversation. Is Donald Trump's former chief of staff ready to flip? We'll talk to the chair of the Intel Committee who is investigating the insurrection. And can Congress find common ground on anything? We are joined by two U.S. senators, one Democrat, one Republican, who are taking a stab at it. With us, we have former aide to the George W. Bush White House and State Department's Elise Jordan, the host of Way Too Early and White House bureau chief at Politico, Jonathan Lemire, and host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and president of the National Action Network, Reverend Al Sharpton, joins us. Joe, a lot of questions pertaining to Congress this morning.
Yeah, I'm just going through the New York Post. New York Post gets really interesting. The cooler it gets, more distracted people get, more interesting it gets. So Mississippi, I don't see anything in here about Mississippi, Elise Jordan. Big day in Mississippi.
They're missing out on covering, you know, Mississippi drama, Mississippi. Yeah. We deserve full coverage, you know, as this Supreme Court case is center stage.
What do you think?
I don't really have that much faith that Mississippi has terrific counsel that's going to be able to make the case, frankly, if I'm going to give my
brutal... You mean to get, the court off of...
Yes, to overturn Roe versus Wade. I don't have that much confidence in
the Mississippi lawyers. Well, and I've got to say also, the hill is so steep. You look, and I know people don't like to think that the Supreme Court looks at public opinion. But you've got like 7 out of 10 Americans saying they do not want Roe overturned. This is a 50-year precedent starting next year. I just looked at my hair. What did I do this morning?
You look okay.
That's just tough to...
It is tough. You can't get it down. People go, what do you put in your hair? You know what I put in my hair?
Oh, my God.
My hands.
Stop. Don't make it worse.
It does nothing. I can't... Yeah, you don't touch it. It's just like it really... It's like...
Can somebody
spray
that?
Gremlins on that old Spielberg thing. It goes wherever it wants.
Water.
But anyway...
Mika, this
my
is what
point
happens
is,
when he travels alone.
I know. My point is this, in between the hair comments, is 70% of Americans support Roe v. Wade.
Yeah.
The precedent of next year, I think, a half century precedent. You look at this poll from ABC News, and it's pretty overwhelming. That one says 60% uphold, 27% overturn. Everything I've seen from Gallup through the years, overturning is either one-third of Americans or less than one-third of Americans. I don't see the Roberts Court move away from the viability test. That's a pretty radical jump. I think they'll slowly but surely evolve in that direction. But right now, what do you think, Jonathan?
Yeah, the Roberts Court tends to avoid the radical jumps. I think that it's the three new justices appointed by former President Trump, Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and Gorsuch are the ones who are going to be, people are going to be really listening to today at oral arguments. And it's not televised today, but at 10 a.m., we're going to be able to hear them talk for an hour or more about this. I mean, it would be a radical departure. Certainly, this has been the hope of a lot of conservatives, a lot on the right for a long time, to bring a case like this that could potentially challenge and overturn Roe v. Wade. And they feel better, those on the right, about this one than they have about other options. This is a much more sweeping decision than what we saw recently about the Texas law. But I do think public polling is, as much as they like to not say it matters, it is at times factored in. This would be a gigantic change for the nation were this to happen.
Well, I mean, the question is, does this court really want to be the court that overturns a 50-year precedent that only 27% of Americans support? I mean, again, it is while they look at the law and they follow the law, they also understand that they're in a constitutional republic. And Rev, it's again, you've got Kavanaugh, who has gone along for the most part with Chief Justice Roberts. I'm not sure what Gorsuch is going to do because nobody's ever sure what Gorsuch is going to do. But I do think that would be a dramatic, dramatic leap that I just don't think the Roberts Court's going to be willing to take.
The concern is that this is the best opportunity they've had to overturn it, the Clarence Thomas wing of the court, if there's right. such a wing. But I don't think that there's any indication that Roberts, and I think you're right about Kavanaugh, would go that way. The concern I have is twofold. One, the people that would be most impacted by it are going to seek abortions anyway, which increases dangers, right. particularly among disadvantaged communities and communities of color. And secondly, those moralists that can't divide personal views, religious or whatever we may have, from how you govern and giving people the right to choose where they want to go in life. And the people that are for life until the child is born, they're pro-life until the kid is born, and then they're against any kind of support for the same children.
Well, and yesterday, and we're going to be getting into it a little bit later, you had a senator from Connecticut give a very stirring speech, really, about the culture of life and the very people that are running around self-righteously beating their chests, talking about supporting pro-life issues are the very people who, of course, won't do what 90% of Americans want and get universal background checks, won't make it harder for people who are mentally unfit to have weapons, dangerous weapons, to have weapons and go shoot up schools and synagogues and churches and country music concerts. They are beholden to special interests in Washington, D.C., not beholden to life. And really, please, anybody that I hear talking about being pro-life again in the age of COVID, where they are deliberately lying, like Dr. Ronnie Jackson, deliberately lying to their people when they know they're deliberately lying to their people and putting their constituents' lives in danger. This is not a pro-life party. It's not even close. And people like Marjorie Taylor Greene can go pro-abort all they want. Nobody believes it. Nobody's listening. They're talking to themselves because we've seen how little they value life because they will lie to their own constituents about taking care of their families.
Well, there are many conservatives, as you know, Joe, who are principally objected to abortion. And today right. is a day that's been circled on the calendar. This is December 1st. This is as close as many conservatives believe they've come. And remember, this is the rationale we heard from many people. Why did you vote for Donald Trump? Judges, Supreme Court justices. We can change the laws of this land if we get Donald Trump into office. Well, he got Gorsuch, then Kavanaugh, and then Justice Coney Barrett as well. Three Supreme Court seats filled by Donald Trump. And today is a day that many people were looking to. Will they actually get the chance? And now they have it to overturn Roe versus Wade. It remains to be seen what the court does today. But Donald Trump and the votes cast for him put conservatives in a position to have a shot at it today.
Yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of Republican on Republican violence over the past day or two on Twitter. It makes me sad. Get it into it. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, we'll get more on what Chris Murphy said as well on the floor. But first, wow, a lot going on here in Washington. Let's turn to Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, unable to control the extreme members of his party. It stems from the most recent Islamophobic remarks from Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, which have sparked a bitter battle within the Republican Party that spilled over onto social media. Yesterday, it was ugly. It started after extremist Marjorie Taylor Greene tweeted calling fellow Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace trash for condemning Boebert's bigoted remarks about Ilhan Omar. Mace then replied with a series of emojis calling Greene crazy, but in more colorful terms. There was also this tweet from Greene. These are sitting members of Congress. Quote, just had a great conversation with President Trump about Nancy Mace.
Oh, my God.
I absolutely love President Trump.
Oh,
here,
my
he's
God.
Our leader.
How sad.
And to that.
How weak. How weak.
To that, Mace responded, quote, don't look now, but it's MTG unable to take the heat, running to the principal's office to tattletale because she can't stand her own 2 feet. Bless her heart. Willie, this goes on, but the bigger issue is controlling this really unspeakable and in some ways disgusting behavior from erupting out into the public sphere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you going to tolerate this or not? Right, Joe? Are you going to tolerate Islamophobia? Are you going to tolerate calling a member of Congress a member of a jihad squad because she's Muslim? Well, Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy apparently tried but failed to end the feud, at least, between Mace and Green, holding separate private meetings with the congresswoman last night. After her meeting, Green suggested to CNN she wants Mace to be primaried. When asked about that, Mace told reporters, quote, all I can say about Marjorie Taylor Greene is bless her effing heart. The New York Times summed it up this way. The carnival-like behavior would amount to little more than a sideshow if it did not have real implications for midterm campaigns and possibly a fractured Republican majority in 2023. Party leaders again chose to remain mum as their backbenchers brawled and Democrats took full advantage of the spectacle, Joe.
Yeah, and here's the problem with Steve, Donald Trump's favorite majority leader, Steve.
Yeah.
When he married Miss Calding, Kevin.
Doesn't know his name. Yeah.
You can't. This when Donald called him Steve instead of Kevin. Personal friend of mine, Bruce Springsteen. But anyway, so Kevin thinks he can control this. And he keeps thinking he can negotiate with somebody like the congresswoman from North Georgia. You cannot negotiate with them. And you need to go to the rest of your caucus and say, hey, if this is what you want, if this is what you want the face of the Republican Party to be going into 2022, hey, donors, if this is what, go ahead, take it, because I'm not going to do it. See, this is a problem with Kev. He's so desperate. He doesn't realize at some point you have to tell people where to go. You follow me, and I will take you to the promised land.
Well,
you don't follow
so,
me.
He looks so weak.
So weak.
Just letting a nutbag just, you know, kind of call the shots and the distraction of this, you know, little back and forth, which, you know, I can't kind of help but to cheer on Nancy Mace. But at the same time, I wish they were just reading some bills, maybe, and just doing boring stuff that Congress is supposed to do instead of this dumb public spat.
Right.
Because we do have an Islamophobic representative who wants to just get Twitter mentions and, you know, go for the shiny object.
Right. And this started when Mace actually criticized a member of Congress for her fascist comments about a Muslim representative. Hateful fascist comments. She called it out. And so then she gets attacked by Marjorie Taylor Greene. And then Greene is attacking her for saying she's pro-abort. Again, a woman who's spreading conspiracy theories that have probably led to the death of some of her constituents. It's on her. It's all on her. And she's talking about being this pro-life candidate. What she doesn't mention is that Congresswoman Mace was raped in high school, dropped out of high school, started drinking, got addicted to drugs. It was ruining her life. She not only pulled herself out of that tailspin, but was she the first woman to go to Citadel?
Yeah, she's a trailblazer.
Yeah, the first woman to go to Citadel. A school, by the way, I've had friends that have gone to that, like, make them break down and weep in just bitter, bitter agony. It's an extraordinary journey for this woman. And I just think the congresswoman from the carpet capital of the world may have picked on the wrong Citadel.
What kind of nasty human being, though, brings up personal trauma like that as a weapon in political warfare?
For sure. And we've heard her attack Congresswoman Boebert for apologizing about Islamophobic remarks. I mean, there's no bottom here for Marjorie Taylor Greene. There's no bottom. And it is representative of a growing wing of Republicans, particularly in the House, the backbench in the House. And it does represent a little bit of a danger here for the GOP. They're widely...
Can I just stop you?
Yeah.
This is not a little bit of a danger.
No, it's significant.
This is the very thing that people in the suburbs of Atlanta, people in the suburbs of Philly, suburbs of Phoenix and Maricopa County, they're like, hey, I like their tax policy. I'd like to pay less taxes. I'd like my small business to have less regulations. I'd like the cops to have a little more, you know, power behind. I like all that stuff. But I can't vote for a fascist. I can't go into crazy town. Right. I'm going to vote for the Democrat.
Right. The GOP is widely expected to take the House back next year. But it's this, that something like this, that could endanger that. And it shows it's going to turn off those suburban voters. It also shows the Republican Party's inability to sort of funnel people together behind more acceptable, broadly palatable general election candidates. And they're too often willing to cave behind those on the fringes, often supported by former President Trump, who can sail through in a deep red district, a primary, but those, but perhaps certainly statewide in the Senate, but even in more of a swing district in the House, might have real trouble if the Democrats can put up a good candidate against him or her. That's the danger here. But McCarthy, to your point, is showing no signs of trying to get that under control. He's simply too concerned about following Donald Trump's marching orders.
The mistakes Kevin is making, Mika, is that if he continues this and allows the craziest people in his caucus to define his caucus, well, there are going to be narrow margins, and he will have to go to the crazies and get them to support him. Thing is, if he's more of a Main Street Republican, if he's more of a Republican the way Republicans were 10, 15 years ago, you talk about economics mainly, you talk about the things that actually matter to small business owners and matter to farmers and matter to you know, Republican Party's natural constituents, then 2022 is probably going to be a blowout. And Republicans are going to have a comfortable lead. And you can tell the craziest people in the caucus, hey, go pound sand. And if you don't shut up, I'm going to strip you of your committee assignments. That's how this works. But Kevin's playing scared. And when you play scared, nothing good happens.
Well, and I mean, I know it's not lost on all of us here on the show this morning that it's not just a danger to the Republican Party. What's happening now, these comments we're talking about, are a danger to members of Congress and to Muslim Americans. I mean, it's unspeakable that these have gone unchecked. And yet, Minority Leader McCarthy has yet to publicly condemn Lauren Boebert's Islamophobic remarks that sparked this all. Even as another video surfaces of her implying Ilhan Omar was a terrorist, the latest video unearthed by CNN was from an event in September. Watch.
One of my staffers, on his first day with me, got into an elevator in the Capitol. And in that elevator, we were joined by Ilhan Omar. Well, it was just us three in there, and I looked over and I said, well, look at there, it's the jihad squad.
It's so hard to watch. It is the same bigoted joke that she told in an event late last month. This is fun for her. Boebert gave a generic apology after that video service to, quote, anyone in the Muslim community I offended, but did not apologize to Omar directly. And it is clear that she's making this a roadshow. This is not just a one-off. The two spoke by phone on Monday, but both congresswomen admit the conversation did not end well, with Boebert demanding an apology from Omar. Meanwhile, at a news conference last night, Congresswoman Omar played a death threat that she received by voicemail. And this is what we're all talking about this morning after that call with Boebert. We want to warn you, the remarks that you are about to hear are offensive and graphic, but this is what happened.
We see you, Muslims. We know what you're up to. You're all about taking over the country. Don't worry, there's plenty that will love the opportunity to take you off the face of this. Come get a Muslim piece of you jihadist.
The message went on to say that she will, quote, not live much longer. Congresswoman Omar has once again called on House Republican leadership to hold Boebert and anyone else who perpetuates Islamophobia accountable. Joe, I have no words. I mean, we're watching.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, say it.
No. You said we're watching.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, no, I was just going to say, you actually do have words on this because you know about this, and I'm not whining about it. It is what it is. I mean, words have consequences. And when the president of the United States accused me of being a murderer 12 times, guess what? We started showing up on kill lists, had to get security around our house 24 hours a day. You know, that's not fun. Yeah. Why did it happen? We had neighbors going, oh, your security. I go, yeah, well, you know, the guy on the, you know, the flag you got hanging up at your house. Yeah, he's the one. He's the reason why every time I walk out, there's somebody I got to go, hey, how you doing? Hey, how are you? Hey, you don't like it. I don't like it. None of us like it. But words have consequences. It's been a pain in the ass, not only for me, but for my children, for you, for your family members, for our family, for everybody in the neighborhood. Why? Because of words. Because there seems, you know, in this, I guess, I don't know, maybe it's the age of Twitter. People think that they can say whatever they want to say and everything will be fine. But there's some people that don't have guardrails. So you say this crazy stuff about people in the media or people in politics, and there's going to be some wingnut that is getting messages from Klaatu through his fillings and the signals coming from, you know, his tinfoil hat and the paper clips that he hangs over all the doorways. And suddenly they're going to get that message from Donald Trump, right? Or they're going to get their message from one of these congresswomen. And somebody gets it. People get killed. There's a consequence to these words. So, Kevin, there's a consequence. You don't want this happening. All right? Republicans should know the consequences of hate talk. They should know the consequences of hate speech. They've got Steve Scalise, who got shot up while playing baseball. Right?
Kevin knows Steve, better.
Kevin knows better. Steve knows better. I haven't heard if Steve has called this out, but certainly Steve should call this out because Steve has seen what hate speech and all this talk, what it leads to. So come on. Come on, we can debate about socialism versus libertarianism, everything in between. But let's just stop this nonsense. It's the short game. It gets nobody anything in the long run, but it might just get somebody killed. Rev, what we're hearing is just you actually had somebody who said deeply offensive fascist anti-Muslim remarks, which, of course, these women have been dealing with since Donald Trump was giving rallies several summers ago saying, go home, right? And she even thought about apologizing and got slammed by Marjorie Taylor Greene for even thinking about apologizing.
No, I watched you and Mika go through the threats because of Donald Trump. And I've gone through threats. I was stabbed once leading the march. And what got me to have the courage to do what Kevin McCarthy seems not to do, and that is start standing up to the fringe on my side of the spectrum, is that the guy that stabbed me, Mrs. King talked to me, Martin Luther King's widow. I went and visited him in jail, and it was a hard thing to do, and I forgave him. And he said to me, looking me in the eyes, he says, you know, I felt bad about it. I almost took your daughter's father. He said, but you don't understand, Reverend. I'd have been a hero if I hurt or killed you. And when I came back out, I talked to some of my ministerial friends. They said, you can't be the same on the other side to him, playing to the hero side of a few fringe people, which is why I started unequivocally saying, rather than, and you and I have had these conversations, rather than trying to mince words or be silent, just unequivocally saying, no. That's too far. That hurts our movement. That's not what we're about. I denounce that. And Kevin needs to ask himself not only what kind of speaker he wants to be, what kind of leader, what kind of man he wants to be. Because if you can't stand up against what is wrong, you don't deserve to be a leader and you don't deserve to be in leadership. It may not be popular, but it defines who you are.
Well, and I'm sure you caught a lot of grief. You know,
absolutely.
You said a lot of things that enraged people and, know, people thought you were anti-Semitic, and your language was very hurtful to a lot of communities. And as you move forward and you talk about Ms. King sitting down and her sitting you down saying, Rev, we got to talk. You people like Kevin can see that, you know, as you move forward, any time there's an attack on a synagogue, Politics Nation is the first there. You're talking about it nonstop. You have the head of the, you know, every group against anti-Semitism. And that continues. And then we saw Brunswick. What were you doing? You're making sure that everybody took Brunswick as a unifying moment to say, hey, this isn't about black people. This isn't about what. This is about white and black people doing remarkable things together. This is what America's about. We're moving forward. Let the word go forth, you said.
Let the word go forth. 11 Southern whites voted in a jury decision what we march for people to do in this country, and that is look beyond race and do what is right. So we're mad about that? All of a sudden, that's meaningless. If they had voted not guilty, we'd have made it meaningful. But it's meaningless when we win trying to bring people together. That's hogwash. And we've got to be able to stand up and say that.
Say, yeah, great things happen. Yeah, Willie, it really is. You look at everything that's going on right now in the Republican Party, and you're just waiting for adults, any adults, some adult, just to stand up and say, hey, enough is enough. Enough with a meeting. Say, we're against fascism. We're against anti-Muslim fascism, just like we're against anti-Semitic fascism.
Yeah, and these shouldn't be close calls. This is the easy stuff in politics. Someone says some of the things that we've been hearing and we just laid out. If you're the leader of that party, that's an easy thing to say, knock it off. We're not talking about policy disputes. If you disagree with Congresswoman Omar on policy, if you disagree with her view on Israel and many other questions, that's the debate. But what we're seeing now is something else. And it is a game because, right, it's a game to a lot of these people. But the problem is they've got a lot of people cheering them as they play that game. We saw it in the video with Lauren Boebert, the crowd laughing, cheering, clapping when she said what she said.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
We're going to come back to this. We want to turn to some terrible and tragic news out of Michigan, where three students were killed and eight others were seriously injured in a shooting at a high school yesterday. Deputies swarmed Oxford High School about 45 miles north of Detroit, responding to a flood of 911 calls around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. There, the undersheriff says they arrested a 15-year-old student. The Oakland County Sheriff says the alleged shooter used a semi-automatic handgun that the teenager's father bought less than a week ago. The victims include 14 and 17-year-old girls and a 16-year-old boy. Three other students also are said to be in critical condition this morning. A teacher was shot as well. Joining us now from outside the school in Oxford Township, Michigan, NBC News correspondent Jay Gray. Jay, what's the latest this morning?
Yeah, Willie, Joe, Mika, good morning. We are in the middle of the parking lot here at Oxford High School, and it's filled with cars, haunting when you consider none of them should be here at this point, left as so many students and teachers fled the situation here. The school still locked down right now. This is still a very active and ongoing investigation here. There won't be any school in the entire district for at least a week, but parents and some of the students here say it's going to be tough to come back at all.
You can't say it won't happen. This can happen anywhere. So, yeah, I'm not sending my kid back to no school that he can't even sit down and get a lesson to know that you go, I'm going to get a phone call and say my child been shot or it's a shooting. No, that's devastating. It's crazy.
I know these kids, that they're hurting, they're sad. Their parents don't know what to do, but it's going to be okay. God will heal everybody.
Hundreds in the town turned out for a memorial last night. This is the only high school in this small town. That means most everyone here either knows or knows of someone who was either lost or injured during the attack. There is an emergency response team on the ground at this point with counselors available to students, to teachers, to parents, to faculty and staff, anyone really in this community who's going to need some help.
Unfortunately, the scene is all too familiar. Again, a 16-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 17-year-old are dead and three others in critical condition this morning. NBC's Jay Gray, Oxford Township, Michigan. Jay, thanks so much. Mika?
And we mentioned earlier the comments from Democratic Senator Chris Murphy yesterday on the Senate floor. Take a listen.
I listened to my Republican colleagues come down here one after another today and talk about the sanctity of life. At the very moment that moms and dads in Michigan were being told that their kids weren't coming home because they were shot at school due to a country that has accepted gun violence due to Republicans' fealty to the gun lobby. Do not lecture us about the sanctity, the importance of life when 100 people every single day are losing their lives to guns, when kids go to school fearful that they won't return home because a classmate will turn a gun on them, when it is in our control whether this happens. You care about life? Then get these dangerous military-style weapons off the streets, out of our schools. You care about life? Make sure that criminals don't get guns by making sure that everybody goes through a background check in this country. This only happens in the United States of America. There's no other nation in the high-income world in which kids worry about being shot when they go to school. It happens here in America because we choose to let it happen. We're not unlucky. This is purposeful. This is a choice made by the United States Senate to sit on our hands and do nothing while kids die. It doesn't even involve any political risk. The changes we're talking about in order to make our schools safe places, they're supported by the vast majority of Americans, Republicans and Democrats.
You know, and the senator should know, he represents Connecticut, a state that endured Sandy Hook. And since Sandy Hook, you look at the numbers, they're overwhelming. Almost 90% of Americans support expansive background checks, universal background checks, that will go as far as we need to go to make sure that the people who are buying guns are law-abiding citizens. Also, tougher registration for military-style weapons, AR-15s. Tougher background checks. No registration, tougher background checks for AR-15s, making sure that gun, which has been a weapon of choice for so many mass shootings through the years, is harder to get by people who are ill-equipped to handle guns. I'm going to say also there is a responsibility, and this was in Sandy Hook, and I'm not exactly sure. You grew up in a gun culture like me. Mika grew up. They always had several guns in their house. Same with me. But I tell you what, my kids can't get to them. They could try all they wanted to. They could never get to them. I think so much a part of this comes down to basic gun safety. And if the NRA hadn't stopped doing their job on preaching gun safety like they did back in the 50s and 60s, and instead of just become crazy lobbying outfit in Washington, D.C., where three people bilk gun owners across America to get as rich as they can and skim money, millions and millions of dollars off the top, maybe they'd be concerned and maybe they would be teaching people and maybe Congress would even pass a law saying, okay, got gun in your house, fine, secure it, keep it from your kid, keep it in a safe place, keep it locked. You and I know this. I know a lot of people watching don't know this. You go into people's house at Thanksgiving, they got shotguns and they're up against the wall. But guess what? They're in a locked case and ain't nobody getting to them except the person that, you know, knows how to get into it.
Well, the NRA, just by being so extremist and by their unwillingness to concede anything, which has always been the strategy, we need some common sense reform. It's the same thing we've been talking about for years. No high volume magazines. We need basic background checks. Why is there person-to-person transfer in so many states? And it's insane that someone can buy an AR-15 without having any background check. And that is true in many states around the country.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, this wasn't an AR-15. This is, we're just talking in general.
Yes.
About gun laws. And my God, Rev, I can tell you in Pensacola several years ago, when we had actually had, Pensacola hadn't had this problem in a while, but, you know, started having gang violence starting to spread across parts of the city. You know, law enforcement, I'd call, I'd say, hey, what the hell's going on down there? And they'd say, just guns all over the place. And of course, we're you know, sort of a gun culture in the South. But they would say people would get guns, they'd go into a parking lot, open up the trunk, and other people just wander up and buy it. Person to person, no background check. We can do a better job. We can respect Second Amendment rights. And at the same time, we can keep our kids safe in school. It's a false choice to say that we can't have universal background checks and a strong Second Amendment.
No, it is certainly a false choice. And it has nothing to do with the Second Amendment. It has, again, to do with demagogues playing to what they consider what is popular to some fringe people. And it's interesting to me, the hypocrisy. You don't want background checks on people carrying weapons that could kill people, but you want all kind of voter ID for people to vote. I mean,
right.
It doesn't make sense. You need all of this identification to vote, but you don't need identification to buy an AR-15. I mean, give me a break. I think that we really need to get serious here. And the normalizing of what we saw yesterday in the school in Michigan is what's concerning, because it's almost not even a top story anymore
right.
when we see these shootings. And in many communities, I preached a one-year-old kid's funeral because he was hit by a stray bullet in a gang war. The guns in the communities, I'm telling kids in our communities, you are complaining you can't find a job, but you can find a gun and hurt other people. So all of us everywhere has got to condemn this kind of debauchery that
right.
we've submitted to.
Well, and you look at the hypocrisy again. We go back to the hypocrisy of people claiming to be the pro-life party. They're the same people that are for no gun safety, against any gun safety whatsoever, against universal background checks to protect our children, to protect the mentally unfit who might commit suicide, use an available gun to commit suicide, that you know, will go shoot up schools. Then you talk about COVID. The very people who are lying to their constituents about how to stay safe, they know better, the doctors know better. And then they lie. I mean, I don't understand just the rank hypocrisy. I mean, we could even talk about being for the death penalty. Right. Fry them all. I mean, again, how does this party call itself the pro-life party?
Right, bringing it back to our discussion on the Supreme Court earlier. And certainly the NRA in many ways has been neutered in the last couple of years because of the scandals we've been talking about. But there's still no political will really on Capitol Hill to do anything about guns. The Biden administration has passed some executive orders, signed some executive orders here or there. But those are all on the margins. Despite speeches like from Senator Murphy, there doesn't seem to be a groundswell, despite these tragedies, of an effort to really have more sensible gun restrictions. And the Rev, I know you've been worried about the Supreme Court case about New York and the possibility to expand the ability for people to carry guns in cities like this one.
No, it's a terrible, terrible situation that we're facing, that they may allow gun carrying openly in New York City in a time that we've seen almost daily shootings, homicides going up. even though they'd gone down for many years. So the incoming mayor, who I know very well, Eric Adams, may inherit a city where people can openly carry guns because of this Supreme Court. We ought to be going the other direction rather than heading this direction. But this is very real and very possible in New York.
Well, and Willie, again, the question that I've had since Newtown is, who could be against universal background checks? Who in good faith could be against universal background checks? Almost 9 out of 10 Americans support that. Republicans support it. The majority of NRA members support it. The majority of every ideological group supports universal background checks. Why not do that? Why not require gun safety, more rigorous gun safety at home, so 15-year-old kids can't get a hold of guns, so 17-year-old kids can't get a hold of AR-15s and go to Kenosha, so our children understand that they can't do that, and the parents understand, or others understand, if you don't lock your gun up, and if somebody dies, you're going to be responsible. There has to be a way. Again, to enact gun safety laws that protect our children and protect our families.
Well, we don't know all the details yet, but it appears to be exactly what you just described in this terrible case in Michigan, where you had a 15-year-old high school sophomore who took a gun that was purchased by his father on Black Friday. So just a few days ago, the sheriff says. And the kid was loading the gun again when the deputies got there, thank God. And they stepped between him and a loaded weapon, got the weapon away from him. They said he was about to shoot 7 more people. So he had 3 magazines with him, they believe. So that's a difficult case. If the father bought it legally on Black Friday, it's on him to lock it up. We still don't know exactly what happened. And to Rev's point, a few minutes ago, we also, as long as we're talking about guns and handguns, Chicago yesterday crossed 1,000 homicides for the year, with still a month left to go. That's the most homicides, Cook County, which encompasses Chicago, more than 1,000 homicides. That's the biggest number since 1994. And they still have a month left to go as they count the numbers there. And the vast majority of those are gun deaths. So there is a sickness in America. There's no question about it, Mika.
There really is. And when you think about between social media and school shootings and COVID, I'm looking at a video of kids in the classroom in Oxford who are trying to keep the door closed because the shooter might come in, and they climb out the window methodically. They're practically in order about it because they're used to this concept. The anxiety that our children, that this generation is growing up with, is incomprehensible. And Republicans, they kind of own it. I mean, I don't know what else they want to own at this point. This entire 40-minute block of television has been about the danger the Republican Party is putting on the American public. And they will do nothing at this point. They will say nothing. It's got to stop. Still ahead on Morning Joe, amid new concerns about the latest strain of COVID-19, one vaccine maker has this message. Don't freak out. We'll talk to the U.S. Surgeon General about Omicron and what the Biden administration is doing to prepare for this variant's inevitable arrival in the U.S. Plus, Donald Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, is set to appear before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack. We'll talk to Congressman Adam Schiff about what his cooperation could mean for that probe. And as we head into the holiday season, supply chain bottlenecks are showing signs of easing. Steve Rattner joins us next with charts on that. Wake up the kids for the charts. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Beautiful shot of the Capitol here in Washington, D.C. at 45 past the hour. We heard some discouraging words from the head of vaccine maker Moderna yesterday, who says the current COVID vaccines could be less effective against the Omicron variant. But as NBC News national correspondent Gabe Gutierrez reports, there could soon be another new tool in the fight against the virus.
We're one step closer to a pill for treating COVID. An FDA advisory panel narrowly voting to recommend authorization of Merck's antiviral pill.
This is an oral medication that can be administered in the comfort of the patient's home, can be given as a prescription and picked up in the pharmacies.
How does this drug stack up against the Omicron variant?
I wish we knew. We're looking in it very carefully.
While as the Omicron variant spreads, the World Health Organization is advising people 60 and older and those with comorbidities like heart disease and cancer to postpone travel. Meanwhile, the White House COVID response team says there are now at least 226 confirmed cases across 20 countries.
One thing has become clear over the last 20 months. We cannot predict the future, but we can be prepared for it.
The CDC is now expanding its surveillance to four of the busiest airports in the country, New York's JFK, Newark, Atlanta, and San Francisco, with increased testing for specific international arrivals. This illustration shows the Omicron variant compared to the Delta strain. Notice how many more mutations it has. It turns out it was on the move earlier than we thought. The first known cases reported in Botswana on November 11th. Officials in the Netherlands also say the strain was apparently already in the country at least a week earlier than previously believed. Still, U.S. officials say it could be 2 weeks before we have more solid information as Americans prepare for the holidays.
I would not change any plans, but that doesn't mean you should be cavalier about it.
Stocks tumbled again, the Dow dropping more than 650 points.
The recent rise in COVID-19 cases and the emergence of the Omicron variant pose downside risks to the employment and economic activity and increased uncertainty for inflation.
Concerns are growing about the effectiveness of therapies and vaccines against the variant. Regeneron now says its monoclonal antibody treatment may not work as well on Omicron as it does on other strains.
We've started with very potent antibodies, so we have to look at how much the hit is, but more importantly, we have to get ready for the next one.
And Moderna's CEO warned he expects a material drop in existing vaccines protection against Omicron. Pfizer applied for the first emergency use authorization of COVID boosters for 16 and 17-year-olds. There's no timeline on when the FDA could act.
So let's bring in White House reporter for the Associated Press, Darlene Superville. Tomorrow, President Biden is expected to announce an enhanced winter COVID strategy. Darlene, what can we expect to hear from the president?
Thank you. That's right. So the president said, as a matter of fact, yesterday when he was in Minnesota on a trip, that he's going to be giving this speech tomorrow to outline a winter strategy for defeating COVID. He said it would not include more lockdowns or more shutdowns, but that it would be more about increased vaccinations, encouraging people who aren't vaccinated to get their vaccinations, people who've only had one shot to go ahead and get their second shot, encouraging people to get their booster shots, and that it would have the strategy would also have more to do with testing, increased testing to find cases and possibly detect the Omicron variant if it's already here in the United States.
And your colleague Zeke Miller has new reporting that the White House really looks at COVID-19 as the driver of all issues with inflation. Businesses struggling to hire, the president sinking poll numbers. Is this going to, do you think, be enough of an explanation for the economy as it carries on this way? How big an issue can Omicron moving forward and the fear of the virus be the driver solely of what's happening with the economy?
Well, it can certainly be a big factor, as we already saw with the initial outbreak of the pandemic and then with the surge of the Delta variant. But there are always other factors that come into play when the economy isn't doing well. But COVID is only just is one part of that. But when things aren't going well for any White House, every president looks for a scapegoat, someone to point the finger at. And in this situation, in this instance right now, COVID is affecting so much of what the president wants to do that it's very easy to point the finger at COVID-19.
White House reporter for the AP, Darlene Superville, thank you very much. Joe, a lot of issues and questions around Omicron as we head into the holidays, which could complicate things.
Could. You know, the thing is, everybody's going, it may be worse than ever. It may not work on this cup. Let's just wait and see. Nobody knows. They're like, 226 cases worldwide? Like, everybody's saying it may be, maybe. We don't know. So just relax. We may not be able to drink water when Omicron comes. I think we
Everyone
will.
Everyone knows that's not water.
I think we will.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Nose down smooth. Burns
Have another one.
Right here. But seriously, I just, we got to cover it. I understand we got to cover it. But the speculation is just crazy. Prepare for the worst, hope for the best. And if you're at home, keep calm and carry on. Unless you're a Yankees fan, Willie, unless you are a Yankees fan. Mm. One of the reasons I like being here is I got the New York Post. I got your daily news. And shocking news in the New York Post. Whew. How do you justify this?
Gary's back.
Gary is back. The laziest, without a doubt. And I don't know Gary or his parents. I'm sure they're fine, good people.
He's a nice guy.
He's probably a wonderful guy. The laziest catcher I have ever seen in the history of baseball. There's a New York Met rounding third base. He's running, and Gary's staring at him. And he's just like this. Can you come up? And he's just like this. He sees him running. And instead of getting down and, blocking the plate, Gary goes like this. And he slides under the tag. Now, let me tell you something.
Yep.
As you know, Jonathan, you and I, we've coached some baseball before.
We have.
And if anybody in Jack Scarborough's team or in years past Joey Scarborough's team had done that, I would have put him on waivers. Right. I'd said, go up to your mommy and daddy and tell them you're going to go home for a couple weeks and think about that. Block the plate and get down. But Willie, this guy, true or false, laziest catcher in the history of Major League Baseball.
Well, he doesn't love reaching for a ball that's not in the strike zone, if that's what you mean, Joe. He's a bit of a stabber, I'll give you that. He kind of stabs at the ball, and sometimes that rolls to the backstop, giving the runner a base or two on some occasions. He's shown over the last few years flashes of brilliance at the plate, not a full season of brilliance, typically. But he got a one-year offer from the Yankees. It's sort of, but he's been like on these, like, probationary status seasons for the last couple of years. Do we bring him back? Do we not bring him back?
Oh,
so
my God.
Gary will be back, but we do have some good backups just in case.
Well, the good news for the Yankees is he doesn't play hurt. He refuses to play hurt. So that means he's on the bench more. All right. Gary Sanchez coming back to your New York Yankees.
It says embattled catcher pitch.
That's our big signing, Joe, in this time where, Max Scherzer's getting $43 million. We're bringing Gary Sanchez back, baby.
And I'm sorry, what are we doing? What are the Sox doing?
Let me check the...
I know, because I know at the trade deadline, they get the Pensacola, Florida, Barnhill's buffet, all-you-can-eat coupons that they were handing out to the players. That's what they got.
Yeah. So far, they've cornered the market on sixth or seventh starters, Michael Wacha, and yesterday, James Paxton, who won't pitch again until at least August, coming off of Tommy John surgery. No one who's going to help us in the moment.
In defense of Wacha, though, his ERA was below six.
It's true. That's true.
For those of you who don't follow baseball, that's about as good as having a catcher who refuses to bend over to tag somebody about to score against your crosstown rival. Let's bring in right now former Treasury official and Morning Joe economic analyst, the legendary Steve Rattner. Mom and Dad, wake up the kids. Steve has charts.
I guess we're making the turn from sports to business.
Isn't it the same thing? I don't know if anybody ever said that. Yeah, sports more interesting.
That was good.
Let's talk about the supply chain.
Yes.
I saw that 60 Minutes piece, Bill Whitaker, a couple weeks ago. Is extraordinary. And, you know, just, I don't know, just sort of the can-do guy in me, I can't figure out why they can't get this fixed. I hear they're making some improvements. What's going on, Steve? Explain to the great unwashed, people like me, what's going on?
I'm going to try to do that, Joe. Well, look, first of all, people are buying more goods and less services.
So that's good.
Well, it's good for good people who sell goods, but it's bad for supply chain. A lot of stuff trying to move through the supply chain because people are trying to buy a lot of stuff. But look, when we look at the supply chain, we'll learn some things also about inflation, about jobs and things like that. So let's take a look at a couple of charts. First, you've heard and read probably a lot about the Long Beach, Los Angeles port. 40% of all of our stuff that we bring in this country comes through that port. This shows you the days of the number of container ships waiting outside that port. And you can see if you went back before October of 20, you'd see it would be almost zero. And then you can see it hit a high of 86 ships floating around in the bay.
What date was that?
That was in mid-October.
And now it's going way down?
And now it is going way down. Mm-hmm. It has actually been cut in half. And as we sit here today, there's about 43 ships sitting out there. You may remember Biden said the port was going to operate 24-7. That didn't seem to help that much. The Los Angeles City Council threatened to put in fines if they didn't get the stuff out of there. That seems to have helped a bit.
So do we expect this trend line to continue?
The trend line seems to be continued. As recently as a couple days ago, there were more ships waiting. It's coming down every day. And that's good news for consumers.
That's pretty dramatic.
It's pretty dramatic.
Now, as the supply chain goes forward, in the 60 Minutes piece we saw, Mika and I saw, they're saying, well, we got it off the boat. You don't have the truckers. You don't have the railroad cars. You don't have the supply. How about that? How about as we get past?
I'm going to address that very question. But before I do that, let me also talk about inflation a little bit, because there's costs involved here.
All right.
And look what's happened to shipping costs over the course of this pandemic. You can see that way back at the beginning, it cost about $1,500 to bring a shipping container from China to the West Coast. And that peaked at $22,000 a container. So you're talking about a 15 times increase in the cost of bringing a container
now,
here.
Is this supply and demand, or are people just bilking people?
It's a little of both. Yeah. I mean, look, if you have a shipping container and you can charge $15,000 for it, you're going to make a lot more money. And that's all feeding into corporate profits. But it is starting to turn down. And you can see it's gone from $22,000 down to $17,000 at the moment. So not great news, but better news. But if you want to get to your question about what happens after the stuff gets here, take a look at what our situation is with truck drivers. So on the left, you can see how many truck drivers there are in the United States. We had about 1.5 million right before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, it fell way off. It's come back, but it's still not back. The number of truck drivers is still not back to where it was in February of 2020. And so that red dot up at the top are the 80,000 truck drivers we're missing. We need another 80,000 truck drivers.
So can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Steve? So we've all been reading stories for years about the poor truck drivers. Pretty soon, truck drivers aren't going to even be needed because trucks are going to drive themselves. And what are these poor truck drivers going to do? Well, there's jobs for these poor truck drivers. Can I ask a question? Where are the poor truck drivers that I've been reading about for the past decade about all their jobs are going away? The jobs are here. Where are they?
The jobs are here. 80,000 of them are not working. We had a shortage before. But this is the broader point across the whole spectrum of business. I was actually had lunch yesterday with a guy who owns the Brooklyn Nets, if you want to get back into sports for a second. And we were talking about his ushers and how 15% of them in a given night tend to decide, you know, I don't really feel like showing up at Barclays Arena.
Right.
And so people are still not fully getting back to work for whatever set of reasons. And we can debate those reasons.
So these truck drivers, though, I mean, I understand about the ushers, but these truck drivers, I would guess their livelihoods depend on this. And I'm just curious why they're deciding not to have these jobs when, again, every story I've read is about the endangered truck driver soon going to be vanishing. And now we have more jobs Yeah, we have more jobs.
We have more jobs.
And people aren't filling them. And I know people will be on Twitter going, oh, you this, you that, oh, da, 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 da. Maybe they don't want to work. Okay, great. I know a lot of people throughout time that haven't wanted to work, but they've had to work. So I'm just curious. Perhaps this is finally the dawning of the age of Aquarius, and we don't have to work if we don't want to.
Well, I think there's a couple pieces. First of all, we have 11 million open jobs in this country, more than we've ever had before.
Right.
So if you don't feel like driving a truck, if you don't like to be on the road, if you want to be away from your family, if you don't like the $23.50, whatever you don't like.
So you can pick something
else. There's 11 million other jobs that you can pick from.
Right.
And so it's become a worker's preference, really, what they want to do. That's number one. And number two is that we do need to start automating trucks, and we are going to start automating trucks, and there will be fewer jobs for truck drivers. That's probably a good thing. And then the third thing is, you say, well, why do people not want to work? There's $2.3 trillion of extra cash sloshing around in people's bank accounts, and I don't want to make this sound cavalier, but we put a lot of stimulus in this economy. People couldn't spend money for a year, and all that money is in people's bank accounts. And so if they don't feel like working one day, they don't feel like going to the Barclays Arena, they don't feel like driving the truck, they don't have to right at this moment. And I don't want to make that sound cavalier. There are plenty of people in this country who are hurting and were hurt by the virus.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a lot of people who have more money in the bank account than they're used to having, and they have more freedom as to what to do.
Well, that's not being cavalier. That's just being reality, Rev. We got 11 million open jobs right now. So it is right now, it is a worker's paradise. It's like, you want to work? Get the job out there. You pick.
Absolutely. I think that the fact that jobs are there is one thing, but I think Steve is right. There are options that a lot of people have that they never had before. So when you have people that were in one or two areas that now have five or six options, you end up with needing more people to become truck drivers or things
right.
that were narrow options in the past. And I think that's what we're seeing the chickens come home to roost.
Yeah, Annalise, you also have the freedom of people to choose what, you know, some jobs that they want to do and some jobs, you know, maybe that they don't want to do. But there is that opportunity out there. It's, I guess it's good for the economy. But at the same time, the Biden administration especially has to recognize that every time somebody sees a help wanted sign, every time somebody sees half of a restaurant shut down because they can't get workers for the entire restaurant, that breaks against them.
Well, and if you think of a job that if you could get another job and be with your family all week, and pass on being a truck driver would be one of them because it's just such a hard lifestyle.
Right.
You know, people who drive trucks, they're gone for weeks on end. They're under time pressure to get a certain amount of miles in. And, you know, back in the day, it was a great way to have a, you know, good upper middle class lifestyle, but, still without a college degree. And now today with other options, and if the price had wages gone up at all with inflation for truck drivers, it's just such a hard career. And then with the pandemic childcare crisis, too, you have one person away and then you're down a childcare giver.
So that's a problem. Hey, Steve, thank you for being here. Come back tomorrow. I saw you had a chart that I saw talking about how corporate profits are at record highs.
Corporate profit margins are at record and corporate profits are at record highs. And it's really interesting why. So if you want, I will happily do that.
And how horrible it would be if we actually tax corporations a little bit more to pay for some of the social safety net that's been torn over the past 40 years. What in the world would happen?
Well,
I ask my dear Republican friends, what in the world would happen? Record-breaking profit margins for corporations. And still, and by the way, it's Joe Manchin that's saying, let's reverse the Trump tax cut. And for some reason, he can't get Democrats to agree with him on that.
Well, you have to not only talk to your Republican friends, you have to talk to Kyrsten Sinema, who has said that she's not in favor of raising taxes on corporations or individuals. And that's a huge problem with the Build Back Better bill, because it's just not going to have the right tax stuff in it.
Yeah, well, I think we need to tax corporations more and the billionaires more. You're not a billionaire.
Well, that's in there. That's in there. The billionaires are in there.
Okay. All right. Steve Rattner, thank you so much for your charts. Greatly appreciate it.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit MSNBC.com/app to download.